Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everybody, I'm Jim Croxton, CEO of Bigger. I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra Talking Shop webinar. I'm pleased to welcome Craig Tracy, MP for North Warwickshire and Bedworth, and co-chair of the All-Party Parliamentary Group for Golf, amongst other things. Throughout this COVID-19 crisis, Craig has worked very closely with Bigger and the governing bodies of golf through the Parliamentary Group. Working with advice from the industry, he was actively involved in advising the government on behalf of the golf industry and advised upon the reopening of the sport of golf in recent weeks. Please feel free to ask questions using the chat function, which will be somewhere on your screen. We'll endeavour to get through all of the questions. It might turn into our version of PMQs, Craig, so brace yourself. We'll look at the questions. We'll use as many as we can. Please don't be offended if you don't get through them. I expect we'll get quite a lot of questions during this session. So, Craig, first of all, thanks for joining us. I don't think we've ever had a correspondent live from Westminster before. This is a big moment for the Bigger webinar series. We better start off. You're well known to me, but not well known to our industry. Perhaps tell us a bit about your background and life to date.
Yeah, certainly, Jim, and thanks for the invite to come and talk to everybody. I started off, I ran my own business, started my own business when I was 21. Never really had that much interest in politics, I have to say. But it was the recession of 2008 when things started to really have an impact on my business. And I just started to get really hacked off with the world. I didn't know who to go and talk to. I didn't know who to turn to, who I could talk to in local government. And it was my wife who gave me those words of wisdom that said, stop moaning or go and do something about it. So, 10 years later, I ended up getting elected for my home seat. And it was quite a journey because I was dropped in at the last minute as a candidate, not expected to win. We had the smallest Conservative majority, 54, I was defending at the time. So it was quite a shock to everybody, I think, when I actually got elected and, had to really hit the ground running. And I hadn't really had any political experience. So what I found really helpful was the work that I'd done, through business and applying that attitude, which I think has, served me reasonably well so far.
Good. And what about golf? You don't just end up as the co-chair of the Parliamentary Group for Golf by accident. So where has golf played a part in your life?
Well, my dad was a huge golf fan and he got me playing from a very early age. I started at Bransworth Castle in the northeast, and then I moved down to the Midlands when I was 20 and played for a number of years at Whittington Heath. Got down to single figures and then had a few struggles with the game, fell out of love with it and decided to take up politics because it was far less stressful. I think even in the current climate, I still do shudder a little bit when I see a golf club, but I've still continued a real love with the game. We used to go every year as a family to watch the Opens, so I toured around with that all around the country. And But politically, when I got elected, one of the first organisations I spoke to were the PGA, because they're constituents of mine, as is the Belfry Hotel. So obviously great roots in the game of golf within the constituency. So it's been brilliant to work with them. And I got involved with the All-Party group through their connection and then eventually progressed to chair it.
Excellent. You've got a big few weeks coming up. There'll be two European tour events in the constituency. You've got Forest of Arden as well, I believe, haven't you? So two tour events coming up. The European stars coming to North Warwickshire.
That's right. I mean, the frustrating point is that it's not really a good selling point for constituents because nobody can go and watch it. So we don't get a lot of the benefits. But, I think if we can get those courses back on the map, I was at the Benson Hedges at the Belfry when it was, I think it was the last sort of big professional tournament they had there, and it was fantastic. And it's been a real shame that it has lost the tournament golf from there. So it'd be great to see it back. And I think Angus and James and the team would be delighted to see it back. And maybe the Ryder Cup one day.
Well, yeah, I've attended, I think it's 4 Ryder Cups at the Belfry over the years. And, you know, it's a venue that I grew up not too far from, probably half an hour away, and spent a lot of time at. And I know that all those guys, it's close house this week up in the northeast. All the greenkeepers were given pretty short notice by European Tour standards that these events were coming. Close house were ready, that they knew a tournament was coming this year, but the others were a bit of a surprise. I know that Celtic Manor getting 2 tournaments back to back with something like 8 weeks notice came as a bit of a shock. Especially as I think we were still in lockdown at the time when a number of the greenkeepers would have been furloughed. So, but actually, from a golfing perspective, it's going to be really exciting to see, you know, the game being played on our shores now. Having watched the Americans play for a few weeks now, admittedly without crowds, it'll be good to see it going. Now, I've had a bit of involvement over the years with all party groups in various roles, but they're not well known in kind of our industry, I think, in terms of how they work in Parliament. Can you just tell me a little bit and tell our audience a bit about what all party groups are?
Yeah, so I think they're one of the really underrated parts of Parliament. I think I chair a few, and I think they're the most impactful parts of the job for me. The purpose of the golf one, it's got a very, very simple remit, which is just to support the sport of golf. It's as simple as that. To make it an all-party group, it has to be cross-party and also cross-house. So we have a number of peers involved as well from the House of Lords. But when I took over as chair, I thought, well, you know, as an all-party group, what we don't want to do is just have a group of MPs and peers thinking what we think the future of golf should be or how golf should work. So I felt it was really important to bring in a number of stakeholders from the game. And so we opened up the membership and got organisations involved with yourself, including yourselves with Bigger. And I think, you know, I would love to say I had great foresight on this, but actually that approach really came into its own when we hit COVID. So we were actually able to have a complete group of stakeholders there representing all different sides of the game, because you know, we've got from the R&A are involved, we've got the PGA, we've got UK Golf Federation, we've got Ping involved, American Golf, the golf unions, and also American Golf, IMG. So we're looking at the entire spectrum of golf. So actually it was so powerful to have those people sitting around the table as they started to kick off.
It was interesting being involved from two perspectives. And one of those is the fact that we were trying at the outset of this crisis, and we'll come on to crisis in a bit, but we were trying at the outset of this crisis to work out who should be in the discussions about what the sport did. And it was interesting that in the end, the right forum for us was the parliamentary group, because there was no discrimination. Everybody was in there by right, and you kind of weren't missing anybody out. So it meant that when we had a discussion, sometimes in the early days, which we'll come on to, the greenkeeping discussions weren't of a great deal of interest to Ping and IMG, for example. But then again, more recently, we've been discussing whether pro shops should be open or whether open competitions, and it's been time for us to take a bit of a backseat. But I'm interested just a little bit now about sometimes some of those early conversations. We ask questions of you, we throw you some pretty big curveballs at times, and you say, I'll go and find out. And by the next week, you've got an answer one way or another. How does that work? I mean, I have visions of you running through Westminster, knocking on Downing Street and saying, Boris, you know, can we play Stableford yet? How does it work in practice?
Well, yeah, it's not far from that. I mean, one of the challenges that COVID actually did bring is that because all of the MPs and the ministers were out of Parliament, it was a lot more difficult to make contact with people, so that you literally, on a day-to-day basis, that would be how we work. And often when we vote at the end of the day, that's a time where we can collar, you know, the PM every day or a minister for a particular department, particularly when they haven't got their officials around them, so we can get a less safe answer from them for want of a better word. So you know, when they talk about modernising Parliament and doing things like remote voting, this is often why there's a lot of pushback from MPs, because that one-to-one contact time is very, very key in what we do. You know, for the last few weeks since we came back, it was great to come back. But I'm probably spending 8 hours a day sat in my office, and I can't come into contact with anybody else. So it makes it makes those connections a lot more difficult. But it's like any organisational business, it's a relationship kind of game. And, you know, the sports minister, him and I got elected at the same time. So it's really handy for me just to have that direct route in and be able to just talk to him and flag up the issues. And, it's not, in fairness, he has been bombarded by me, just not just on golf, but on things like hotels and catering, which all comes under the remit of the Culture, Media and Sport Department. But as I say, it is very much an old-fashioned relations game.
And I think it seemed to serve us well in those early days. And I know that we're grateful to our friends at England Golf, who also had a decent line into the sport, Ministry for Sport, DCMS at the time. But when lockdown came on the 23rd of March, I think it was mid-morning on the 24th when we'd had some clarity around where greenkeeping sat. I know that the evening of the 23rd was certainly one of my most interesting times on social media. I learned a few new words from my vocabulary after a couple of tweets that night. And I mean, we have to be real and say that at that point in time, it was a very scary time for all of us. We didn't know what this crisis was going to turn into. I suppose we still don't, to an extent. A lot of our members were fearing for both their health, their family's health, their jobs. And it was getting quite heated. And we got really good clarity very early on from the sports ministry, from DCMS, which was we were then able to come back from you and go out very clearly to our industry. So I think people would probably expect that was the first time we spoke, but actually, I mean, the all-party group was in discussion about COVID sort of well before then. You seem to take quite a sort of proactive stance to this early on. Was that a proactive choice from your perspective?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we sort of began conversations with the department around about 2 weeks before lockdown actually started, and it was on a number of points. But I think, you know, the feed-in that we had from yourselves, actually the very first conversations with the department were around greenkeeping staff and course staff, because that was the first part in the jigsaw that obviously if courses were not allowed to be looked after and maintained during a lockdown period, then the recovery would be so far prolonged at the other end. We were talking maybe 6 months before they could come out of it. So the conversations that we had and the group more broadly helped to drive that. And I think what we were able to do in those initial meetings was, my vision was, right, we want to think about the initial impacts. So that was, you know, the green staff. But then we want to think as well, because you don't want to just go to a ministerial team and say, all right, we want more money and we want this and we want, you know, golf to be back first. We wanted golf to be part of the solution as well. So we also talked about how golf could help, if you like, and if the courses were going to be closed, whether the hard standing could be used, if it was needed for testing centres, things like that. So there was actually an offer put to government in that respect, you know, that how can we be part of the solution? And then critically, how we could then make a safe return as soon as possible. And my vision was always that golf had the ability to be one of the first sports or leisure activities to return, but we had to make the case for that. But actually, they all sort of went fit together very, very nicely, because I think golf actually took the decision before they were told to lock down. Actually, England Golf took a decision to recommend to their members that the course is closed. And that wasn't, you know, missed by government, that they saw a responsible attitude being taken. So we were going in with a very good, a good story to tell. And that story's just continued throughout the lockdown.
Yeah, I won't ask you to throw any other sports kind of under the bus, as it were. But I know that talking to you at the time, first of all, for perspective, in Ireland, they didn't get permission, if you like, to maintain golf courses for a good week to 10 days after their lockdown came in, which meant that actually greenkeepers were sat at home, golf courses were just completely stopped. And that was the sort of, I wouldn't call it a doomsday scenario by any means, but it was certainly the thing we were trying to avoid here. And I feel that quick decision from government, and thank you for that, made a big difference to give us some continuity. But also, I know you said at the time, and I think this feeling came out of DCMS as well, that golf's reaction, its kind of joined up reaction. And I would say, as someone that's been in the golf industry for now far too many years, we haven't always spoken with one voice. And in fact, too often we've probably all of us, and I imagine, certainly I know that I've done this, I imagine probably Bigger has in past, has got a little bit siloed and thought about its own importance rather than the sport. But it was interesting to see the whole sport come together and actually agree, I mean, in the end, agreeing the wording on documents and agreeing how golf should close, how golf should open. And I think that wasn't true of every sport, was it?
No, definitely not. And this is something that has been relayed to us by the by DCMS, that, you know, what they were incredibly impressed with how organised the game was, and it came together with one voice. And I think that was critical in terms of getting our asks looked at. I think the APPG was able to facilitate that because we had the key people around the table very quickly. Like you say, it was pretty much next day. I mean, interestingly, one of, you know, technology has seen a big boost as a result of lockdown. But I think we had a bit of luck on our side that had we tried to do a, you know, around the table meeting to get all those people together, we'd have probably been waiting 2 years to get the level of people that we had around that table. But because we were doing it on Zoom, and we just managed to do it within 24 hours. So, you know, it was great. And, you know, like you say, I mean, you said don't throw anybody under the bus. I'm not throwing anybody under the bus, but I know certainly if you look at football, for example, all the different leagues were looking for different things. And, you know, the amateur game was looking for different things to the professional game. And you've got the point now where, you know, amateur football still hasn't come back. There's no real vision on when spectators will be able to come back to football matches. Whereas with golf, this is all part of the process. And as I say, it's because that respect that's been built up with government that we're able to do these. And like I said, you know, it is very much a relationship game. And as I said, to be able to come out of this first, out of the recovery phase, was a great achievement. And it was everybody involved playing their part on that.
Yeah, it's been interesting that, and whilst obviously sport is devolved, so we've got different situations in England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales, and they're all at different phases of their kind of reopening. I think from a greenkeeping perspective, we're pretty much the same all around. You know, basically greenkeeping is back to normal with the proviso that we keep social distancing, sanitising, you know, lots of measures in place to keep the greenkeepers safe. And also that slightly different setup on golf courses. Been involved in a discussion still yet again today about when we're going to get rakes back on golf courses. And I think the view is still there's just it's not the right thing to do. It's introducing the scientists would call it a vector when we don't need to do so. So we've got to find ways around that.
Bigger members work in some of the most spectacular scenery and landscapes anywhere in the world, and with most carrying some form of camera about their person, it's never been easier to snap a picture and get involved with our annual photographic competition. We're on the lookout for images from throughout the year that showcase excellence in greenkeeping, highlighting how a well-presented course can enhance the surrounding environment. Images of greenkeepers at work within the context of the wider landscape are especially encouraged. Each year, the winner of the competition receives a state-of-the-art piece of technology and a framed print of their winning photograph to be presented at the Bigger Welcome Celebration at BTME. 12 entries will also be selected for inclusion in Bigger's annual desk calendar, distributed to every course manager and head greenkeeper member of the association each year. To enter the competition, email high-quality versions of your photographs, along with your name, membership number and club name, to comps@bigger.co.uk before the deadline at the end of August. Head to the Bigger website to find out more. Links are going to be in the show notes. Best of luck to you.
But the sport now, our conversations, which have been on a weekly basis with the parliamentary group, have been about improving what is already a pretty good situation. Whereas I'm involved as a volunteer and coach in a couple of other sports, and so I mean, football last night for my daughter's team, they actually managed to tackle each other in training for the first time, and it was wonderful to see. But it felt like it's taken us until nearly August to be back doing something that looks like football when we've been playing golf since the middle of May. So, yeah, we have been very, I guess, lucky in some respects, but I think we've made our luck by, as you say, presenting a good united front. And I wanted to talk just briefly then now about that first piece of work around, we discussed about getting, making sure greenkeepers were allowed to work. The most controversial thing I think that we got involved with then was then actually in taking the decision to tell them what was allowed and what wasn't. The essential maintenance guidelines, which were produced jointly between us, ourselves and the RNA. We have had one slightly mischievous question asking if it had come to an argument between, I guess, Bigger and the RNA over a point of order on that, who would have won? The only thing I'd say to that was that the discussion group that formed the guidance had more people from Bigger on it than it did from the RNA. So I'm guessing if it came down to a full tug of war, we'd have won. The nice thing to say is actually, I mean, the guys we work with, and I think we've got at least one of them on the call listening, are all agronomists and former greenkeepers. They understand the trade, and we were in pretty good consensus. But it was an unusual thing for us as an organisation to do. In fact, to tell our members to stop doing their job as well as they normally do. And it was pretty unpopular in certain quarters. I guess it was like anything. I guess it's probably like how the budget comes every year. You know that if nobody likes it, you've got it somewhere near right because you haven't gone too far either way. But how important do you think that was in terms of, again, setting, telling your peers in the government that we were behaving? Do you think that made a big difference in how easily we've got back to playing the game?
Absolutely. And I can't understate, you know, the amount of help that Bigger gave at the very outset, because it's probably, I must admit, from my perspective, it wouldn't have been one of my first thoughts around, you know, the greenkeeping angle on this. We were thinking particularly of the, you know, the clubhouse or the course itself. So that input was invaluable. And then because you've got people who are, you know, we're dealing generally on the APPG with the chief executives of the organisations, I think there was a mutual respect between everybody. And from an all-party group, we haven't really got skin in the game. So we've got no axe to grind. We just want to make the best possible case. So I think that is what makes it such a valuable platform, because we can look at things very objectively. And, you know, if push did come to shove, and I don't think there's been any really contentious issues so far that I can think of over the course of how many ever weeks it is of discussing things week by week and reviewing the situation. But I think that if it had come to it, then I think obviously the APPG could help, you know, mediate on that and get to that consensus. But it just genuinely wasn't needed, because I think it was that mutual respect throughout the bodies. And I have to say, it did amaze me how well everybody has worked together, because, you know, having been involved in the game, as I say, for a number of years, you know, I've never seen people working together as well as they did, and looking at mutual interest as well. And there's been sort of no real, you know, hierarchy. Everybody's pitched in together. Everybody's contributed. Everybody's been valued. And I think that is exact. I don't think it's any coincidence we got the results that we did.
No, I'd agree with that. And I think there was somebody, and I won't name a name, kind of said on one of those early calls about the maintenance guidelines, they asked, you know, me directly, Jim, are these right? Is this what we should be working towards? And I said, yeah, you know, a lot of good people plus me have been involved in creating them. They are right. And the guy said, well, okay, that's kind of good enough for us. If it's good enough for the RNA and Bigger, then we'll work with it. And then the same has been true then when we've got into talking about the rules of the game, or whether open competition should be allowed, and whether food and beverage should be allowed. I mean, I'm not going to put forward a strong opinion in an area like that, but there was a time in the sport of golf not too long ago when I think egos or empires might have got in the way of that decision making. And it gives me a bit of confidence for the future that we can now, and you've talked on the calls, and we'll come to that in a moment, about the sort of the government's agenda and where sport fits in. And probably that earlier point about how golf can help and be a solution for other things, that probably for the first time all the organisations will put golf ahead of their own business plan or their own strategy, and make sure that strategies and business plans align with the sport. And I know you've said clearly on our calls that that's the case. So looking towards that, I can't think of anything else at the moment to ask around the sort of the crisis itself. We are where we are. We still don't quite know when we're going to come out of this normally. And we know that we heard on our call today, Craig, that that the economy of the sport is going to have a tough few months, particularly as we get into winter. We're starting to see redundancies amongst our members, which we expected, and it's sad and difficult, but we know it's going to happen. But looking more towards the future, how do you think, first of all, where do you think the opportunities are for our sport? Just a nice easy start for 10 there. And also, where does the APPG come in with that, and how do we work with you? So perhaps the government's kind of key agenda points might be a good place to start, and where golf can touch with on those.
Well, I think there's a number of areas where it really touches with government at the moment, and looking at opportunities. You know, I think my sort of vision, and I think this was something that was put in some of the first meetings that we had, was that what we wanted to try and do was, when government talks about golf, it talks to it in the same vein that it does cycling and walking, that it's seen as a something that they actively promote. And I think, you know, we're on the way to having done that. I think there's what's happened is, in the reports that we're getting back, is that people have come back to golf in greater numbers than before COVID. I think what we want to do now is try and keep those people. And, you know, we're hearing that green fees are slightly sloping off, but the membership boosts have been fantastic. So I think there is a window of opportunity to really get people to fall in love with the game over a long period, or re-fall in love with the game. And I must admit, I did buy myself a pair of golf shoes the other day, so I don't know whether that's my tentative steps to going back to it. But I think it's about holding on to those people that have come back to it first and foremost. I think some of the stuff that we've looked at the APPG over the last 12 months was particularly around more female participation and family participation, because that's what really one of the drivers on in Europe about why, you know, there's greater involvement in the game, because there's a lot more looking at, say, family membership. So it's how we encourage that, how we look at the technology and how we've used that to evolve the game. You know, I think there has been some enforced changes for a lot of clubs, but the feedback that we're getting, that these in general have been for the better in the short term. So I think there's some really exciting things that we can do. And then, you know, I would also really like to use the APPG to promote golf as an industry for people to work into. You know, I think we don't necessarily promote it well enough and look at how we get into schools to say, you know, I mean, I've got, like you highlighted, I've got some amazing golf courses on my doorstep. I would think that very few of my constituents would ever think about going to be a greenkeeper, or, you know, maybe they could work within the golfing industry, but they would be so excited if they could do it. So I think with some of the incentives that government's put forward over the last week or so around traineeships, so paying organisations £1,000 to take on a trainee for a limited time, and then the apprenticeships, so the benefits of apprenticeships. And I know that's something that you're really passionate about, and you've made the case really well for in the APPG over the last sort of year or so. So, you know, I think there's some great chances ahead for the industry, but I think we have a time limited chance to make the most of those. And that's why I wanted to be first out the blocks as part of the recovery to really maximize those. But I think we've got the right people around the table talking about it, but what we've just got to make sure is we don't just talk about it, we actually put those into action like we have done over the past 12 weeks or so.
Well, I wouldn't be doing my job at Bigger if I didn't mention that how pleased we are to see that membership of a club can go up even when the clubhouse is closed, because in the end it's the golf course that drives people to the sport of golf. And that's probably a bit of a cheap shot, because golf clubs are a difficult business to manage. They've got to balance it all, but we've always felt that the prime asset of any golf club is the course itself, and that's where investment should focus. I would certainly go and play a great golf course with a closed clubhouse ahead of playing an average course with the best locker rooms in the country. So, you know, that's probably my political point made for the day in my world of life. But in terms of what you're saying around education, I think that is critical. Apprenticeships are crucial to greenkeeping. You know, the vast majority of our members have begun their career as an apprentice or a trainee one way or another. That's probably what separates the British greenkeeping industry from our friends over in America, where the majority come through a university structure and arrive in management. And you know, we've worked really closely through our relationship with the Greenkeepers Training Committee and the home unions to build great apprenticeships. We've got two new ones launching this year. So we've had the level two for a few years, but the level three and five are all launching. The first students are signing up as we speak, which is going to give us a great building block. Sadly, as I mentioned before, in a slightly contracting job market, but that might make apprenticeships a little more easy for clubs in terms of they are a little bit cheaper, bringing trainees through, and the incentive, I think, will be important for that. I do hope that the current commitment to funding apprenticeships stays. You know, I'm a taxpayer. I understand that all this is going to need paying for a bit, so we have to be a little careful. But I think that focus on the apprenticeship side will be really good for us. I agree with you completely. I don't think we have a massive role to play in ensuring that golf clubs keep their members. I think that's for our friends at the GCMA, PGA, Home Unions, UK Golf Federation to do. We'll keep preparing great golf courses and hopefully ones that people like playing, but that customer experience is going to become very important. I think I'd be in trouble if I didn't talk to a member of parliament about issues around climate and sustainability and how that fits in. I know that I've talked to you in recent weeks around help with working with DEFRA around the National Action Plan on pesticides, for example. But equally, we're working very closely with the RNA on the Golf Course 2030 project. We believe that climate change is here for golf, whether we believe it politically or otherwise is a separate issue. Do you think that demonstrating a real commitment to sustainability in the way that we manage our golf courses, I'm thinking specifically around water use and biodiversity, is going to be important in keeping us on the right side of government?
Absolutely. I mean, I was private secretary for a while to Andrea Leadsom when she was business secretary, and you know, the net zero was huge for her in the business department. Now, it's always had an impact within DEFRA, like you said, but when you see it start moving into the business area, and I think the Prime Minister's announcement last week about how he sees the future of the economy is all around green technologies, and I think there will be lots of funding opportunities. You know, if we're coming back to innovative technology, etc., for people who embrace the global challenges that we've got, and you know, it makes complete sense that the golf courses have a massive part to play in that. And I know it's something obviously that as an organisation you look very closely at and promote incredibly well. So you know, that voice feeding in, you know, we have the usual suspects like the NFU are, you know, strong voices, but they don't always necessarily, there's sometimes conflicting voices on, you know, some of the pesticides that are being looked at. And we've had challenges in the neonics and things with the, you know, over the past 12, 18 months around European legislation. But I think, you know, making a case for what really helps your industry is hugely important. And I think a lot of people actually don't get the importance of lobbying government and of actually interacting with them, because I think there's often a misconception that big business gets what it wants, but actually the reason that big business often get what they do ask for is because they're the ones putting themselves forward. So unless you're part of the operation in making those cases to those government departments, be it directly or through the all-party group, then you know, you're not going to get the things that you want. And you know, there is a definite misapprehension or misconception, sorry, that MPs and government know everything. You know, that's my wife will attest to that greatly. But they unless we talk to people, and I think, unfortunately, lobbying got a little bit of a bad name because it could have been used in the wrong way. But when it's done correctly, lobbying is so powerful. And unless those voices get through, then government is never, ever going to get where you're coming from. And the challenge is there's plenty of other people who'll fill your footsteps and have those conversations with them. So, you know, I think, you know, organisations, having that group commitment like you do, where you can talk on behalf of your members, is incredibly powerful on a day-to-day basis, not just when we're going through a you know, unprecedented COVID pandemic.
I think last week was something like Water Awareness Week. It coincided with the Open Championship, which would have been interesting, particularly if we had a real dry Open Championship, if that had taken place last week. Our members won't know this, but it's Craig's fault that we've had rain the last few weeks. I complained to him about the drought that we had in May on one of these calls, and it immediately started raining and kind of been on and off ever since. So he carries a fair amount of clout in that world. But joking aside, we were contributed to a podcast last week about water awareness. We know that in England particularly, too many of our golf clubs are still reliant on mains water. We know that we're getting droughts and hot summers, and you know, pressure is going to be brought to bear on water, and we need as an industry to be demonstrating to you in government and to the Environment Agency and DEFRA that we are first of all cautious with how we use water, that we use water appropriately and sparingly where we can, secondly that we're measuring our usage, and thirdly that we that we've got a plan to not use potable drinking water where possible, because I think it's something like 60% of English courses have a reliance to some extent on mains water, which is not what we need to have as a sport. You know, we, there's no way we can be making the case that we're more important for the use of that water than the population is in a growing population, particularly a growing population in the southeast of England where the most drought is occurring. So water is very high on our agenda. And I think in terms of things like DEFRA's regulatory world, the Golf Course 2030 project, is really looking to make sure we recognise the direction of travel quite rightly, is to applications to the golf course that are of lower toxicity. That's the right decision. And also that all usage should be done in a minimal and sort of sparing way. Again, that's the right thing for our industry to do. What we want to make sure is that the decisions made by DEFRA, if you like, or used to be CRD, are done based on good science and a real understanding of what the impact is on the amenity sector, which golf sits within. And that's where I think, you know, I'll be talking to you over the next few weeks and months to make sure we're getting those conversations done correctly.
Did you know that Bigger, alongside our partners ICL, offers a fantastic Continue to Learn scholarship opportunity for our members? The scholarship invites 5 Bigger members along to attend the Continue to Learn at BTME education programme. Worth approximately £500, the scholarship comprises 3 nights' hotel accommodation and 15 hours worth of education. The application process takes place during July, so head to the member opportunities section of the Bigger website to find out more. Links are in the show notes.
In terms of questions, we've got a couple of questions here from our audience. This could be I got into trouble for calling a question a hospital pass on the last one of these I did, but it's it's another one. You mentioned the sort of capitalizing on the upturn in participation. How do you think, and you, if you ever recover from your golfing yips and you went back to the sport, you're that prime candidate, the guy with a family that might want to play some golf as a group. How do golf clubs actually capitalize on this? What do you want to see happen across golf clubs that's perhaps different to what we've seen in the past?
So I think one of the interesting things was when I came back to golf through the APPG after probably, as I said, 10 years out, there were still the same conversations going on about, you know, is the clubhouse friendly? Is it keeping up with modern times? Are the courses welcoming? And I think there is a body of work to do around that. And I think there's a recognition within the industry that they could be made a little bit more inclusive and a little bit more, you know, enticing for people to come and be a member. One of the things that I think is also quite interesting is that one of the things that most of us don't have these days is a lot of time. And I think that 4 or 5 hour commitment to a round of golf is actually quite a big thing. So I think there needs to be a little bit of thought about how you can get people in to play maybe on short courses. And I've seen that some clubs off the back of COVID are looking at, you know, short tournaments or, you know, 6-hole competitions, things like that. And so those are the kind of thing that I think from my personal perspective would actually would bring me back. Maybe also if you could have like on a bowling alley where you can have those bumpers down the side just to keep you in play. I always think the professionals have an unfair advantage when they've got a crowd in place to keep them on track. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I loved the golf clubs that I've been a member of, but I wouldn't say that they were particularly somewhere where you wanted to take your family or you know, or introduce somebody new to. So I think we really need to think about how we can get much better at a more community spirit within those clubs.
Yeah, I agree completely, Craig. I think what's been interesting this last few months, I mean, this phrase which we hear so much nowadays, this new normal, I think that one of the things that we hear on these calls nowadays in every conversation I have is how many of the things that we've had to do because of COVID that we're going to continue doing post-COVID. It was very interesting. A new person on the group earlier on the parliamentary call saying that it's forced her to change the golf club that she runs, but most of it is going to stay because it's actually been more positive and more inclusive. And certainly the golf club that my kids are members of, I'm not currently a member. I'm a bit like you. The yips are probably keeping me off the golf course a bit more than they should. But they have become, you know, through this process, far more friendly to the juniors and families than they perhaps were. It was a pretty good place beforehand, but it's certainly even better now, and I think that's going to stay.
I think just on that, Jim, the what's interesting is that the during the summer there's a window of opportunity that we discussed today that I think with you know, with things like childcare provision and people going back to work, that there is an opportunity for golf clubs to open themselves up to audiences where because they qualify as out school settings. And you know, I think again that's another potential outlet that golf sits so well with as an outdoor summer sport. You know, all being well, I'll turn the rain off for the summer for you, Jim, if that's it. But as in general, you know, if we get a half decent summer, then you know, I'm sure kids would love to do that. But it needs that little bit of outreach by the courses to actually maybe think about their changing of mindset. But like you say, the introduction of things like online booking for a lot of clubs is, you know, has been a step that they thought their members wouldn't really adapt to in a lot of instances. But they've, as I said, now it's in there. A lot of them are saying that they wouldn't change back again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And I know something else that struck me when we spoke earlier. I wouldn't say you're surprised because you've worked closely with employees in your constituency and obviously been involved in golf for years. I mean, Bransworth and Whittington Heath, two great courses with great greenkeeping teams in. But you were struck by the sort of technical level that greenkeeping inhabits. And I was telling you earlier on, we're working with our friends in America, the GCSAA. They've piloted a program the last 12 months or so to bring school kids into golf courses. They're producing, we're working with them to hopefully try and replicate this over here, a kind of an out-of-the-box kit that allows a golf course manager or a head greenkeeper and his team and others within the club. Ideally, let's involve the pro, let's involve the manager, let's involve the head of catering if there is one. But introducing kids to the different jobs in golf, but also showing them all the science in that, the technology in that, moisture measurement and you know, the sort of the mathematics involved in all the various parts of greenkeeping. And I think that's where our opportunity is. If we're going to have young people and families on the golf course, we've got to make sure as an industry, greenkeeping in particular, that we show greenkeeping in a good light and also show it as a good career choice. Because I'm not sure right now we've done enough that golfers are thinking, I hope my son or my daughter, and we're seeing an increasing number of ladies join the profession, that they're thinking, I hope they go into greenkeeping when they're older, or wouldn't it be nice if they did? Whereas actually, I've learned from my time in it what a wonderful profession this can be, and a horrendous one if, you know, when the weather's bad or when times are difficult. But it is a great profession. So yeah, your support on that process will be very valuable.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, till we got talking at the outset, I'd never, you know, hold my hands up, hadn't appreciated what a skilled profession the greenkeeping industry had you know, I say it evolved into. I know it's always been, you know, a very key part to the game, and I completely agree with you that most people are playing on the basis of the course, and it will cover a multitude of sins elsewhere. So without the course, you haven't got the club. You know, it doesn't. You can operate the course without the club, but you can't operate the club without the course. And I think that is key. And you know, I think it's certainly for my time, it can be a thankless task, because members always know better, but my constituents always know better than me in terms of every decision that's made. But you know, you guys are backing it up with the science. I think in terms of getting younger people in, what you also shouldn't underestimate is how much more environmentally aware younger people are than maybe they were, you know, 15, 20 years ago, and it is a big area of interest for them. So I think, you know, talking about the science to them and getting them involved from an early age, it does really feed people into the profession. And actually, you know, there's a lot of people who enjoy that working outside. They enjoy working within the communities, and often might, if they're more hands-on, might struggle in terms of how they approach the studies, because they don't actually see what the end goal is for them in this, because is going to university going to help them to get a job greenkeeping? But I think that engagement to really inspire the next generation of greenkeepers is something that, you know, I'd love to help you with, and I know you're really passionate about as an organisation.
Yeah, interesting. One of the I think unexpected positive outcomes of this period, the lockdown period itself, we got a lot of feedback from golf clubs who had opened their gates, whether they wanted to or not, potentially to the members of the public to use for recreation. It seems that there were some isolated horror stories, and we saw a few across social media, but generally speaking, the public were respectful of golfing environments. But a lot of them were going onto golf courses for the first time and had probably got a Augusta-esque view of what to expect, and actually came to see beautiful landscapes, lots of biodiversity. They weren't seeing overwatering, they weren't seeing chemicals being sprayed everywhere, and actually realised that the golf course itself is a lovely habitat and a very sustainable habitat in a lot of places. And I think you're right. I think that's one of the areas we can point to. I see the direction of travel in our sport, and particularly with you know, reacting to climate change, reacting to the sustainability agenda, but also the fact that I think greenkeepers, as a rule, are environmentally minded. I mean, that you don't normally choose a profession that means working in all conditions outdoors, lovingly tending a piece of land, if you don't want that land to sort of thrive and survive. And I think we've got an opportunity to completely flip that public non-golfing perception that golf courses are these bright green, you know, chemically infused, overwatered areas, into what actual truth is, which is that they're managed beautifully. And I mean, we have an ecologist on staff at Bigger who advises golf clubs the length and breadth of land on how to be more sustainable and more environmentally friendly. I think that's really important. I've got a possibly a little slightly, a down question. I hope we get one more positive question to finish on. A couple of people concerned about whether or not we're going to see this second spike, as it's known, and whether that might take us into any kind of new lockdown or tightening of the restrictions. Do you think that we're well placed as an industry if those restrictions tighten again? Are we going to be, hopefully allowed to continue to work as we were the first time around, but maybe even able to continue playing because of the work that's gone on through the last few months?
Yeah, so I think as a bit of reassurance, I think if we did have a second spike, and you know, fingers crossed we don't, things are looking, you know, positive at the moment, but it's a lot of it is down to individual behaviours. It will look very different to the first wave. We understand a lot more about the disease and or the virus, and I think you would probably look at a lot more localised lockdowns. So and shorter term lockdowns rather than a blanket lockdown as we saw. And I mean, case in point was, when we had the Leicester lockdown recently, you know, the first call I get was from Jeremy at English Golf Union saying, you know, are there any golf courses in the affected area? Where can we find the ring? And we were able to get information to those courses ahead of I think in the end it affected three, but they were allowed to remain open because they're an outdoor setting. And I think, again, that's something else that's been recognised, is that outdoors is an awful lot safer than indoors. So, which we didn't have the luxury of this understanding when things first came out. So I think, as I say, even if we do get a second spike, then it will look very different. And, you know, quite simply, we can't shut down the economy again. I'm sure we're all taxpayers on this call pretty much. And, the money is just not there to fund as we did the first time round. It was definitely the right decision to do it in terms of wider protections. But as I say, as the science has evolved and we understand not just the disease, but also how we can better mitigate against it, you know, I think, it would end up looking very different.
Good. Well, I've got a silly question just come in. Do you know who the best golfer is in Parliament?
Well, it's certainly not me. I don't actually, because we've just set up a charity now as well through the APPG, which is going to have a playing arm to it. I've not rushed to set that up because I didn't really fancy it, I must admit, but I'm going to, I think I'll offer my services caddying or raking bunkers. You can teach me how to rake bunkers. But apparently Julian Knight, who's the chair of the Culture Media Sports Select Committee, is a handy golfer. But as I said, this might just be in their own minds because I've never actually seen, and I'm sure we all know golfers who have been legends in their own lunchtime.
In one of my former lives, I used to play a match every year against the Parliamentary Golf Society, and there was a couple of. It was interesting that the lower handicappers definitely seemed to be from the Conservative Party rather than the other one. So perhaps that spoke of perhaps the old golf industry. Well, Craig, thanks a lot for joining us today. I really appreciate that. More importantly, thank you for your support of the sport the last few months. It was already going in a good direction, the work with the old party parliamentary, but I do think it's been critical this last few months, and I thank you for your leadership on that. I think I can speak for the Belfry, one of your constituents, for James and the guys, to say that we ought to at least try and cure you of your yips. We better get you down there for a lesson with one of the pros down there. I know if you do come down, we can get Angus and Jamie to get you out on one of the mowers and have a bit of fun on one of the fairways. I'm not sure they'll let you go on a green, but we'll get you on one of the fairways to start with, I think. So. Thanks ever so much for being part of this webinar. I really appreciate it. I hope everyone's enjoyed listening to Craig and learning a bit more about how both Parliament works and perhaps more importantly how the golf industry and bigger work with Parliament and with legislators to try and get us through this. This webinar will be available in the members area of the bigger website within the next few hours. Thank you very much for joining us. We hope you'll join us again soon. And for details about future Continue to Learn Extra webinars, please visit the What's On page of the bigger website. So once again, thank you, Craig, and thanks, everybody, for listening.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.